You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our second of four podcasts on the management of uterine fibroids, hosted by the Med Learning Group, titled Development of Novel Therapies for the Treatment of Patients with Uterine Fibroids. What are the data telling us? This series will be designed to meet the educational needs of US-based obstetrician gynecologists and other healthcare professionals involved in the care and treatment of patients with uterine fibroids. In this episode, we will be talking about the importance of novel therapeutic approaches in the management of uterine fibroids. I am Surabhi Dangi Garimella, Medical Director with the Med Learning Group, and I'll be your host today. Joining me are Dr. Andrea Lucas, founder and CEO of Carolina Women's Research and Wellness Center, and Dr. Hugh Taylor, Anita O'Keefe, Young Professor of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences, Professor of Molecular, Cellular, and Developmental Biology, Chair of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences, Yale School of Medicine, and Chief of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Yale New Haven Hospital. Dr. Lucas and Dr. Taylor, thanks so very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us.
Let's kick off the conversation with understanding the basic epidemiology and pathogenesis of uterine fibroids. What are some of the molecular mechanisms that trigger fibroid development? Dr. Taylor, if you would like to start.
Yes, well, fibroids are very, very common. As we know, the epidemiology suggests that about 75% of women will develop fibroids before they reach menopause. Fortunately, most of these are asymptomatic. Only about a third of them, or 25% of women, will develop symptomatic fibroids. We know a little bit about their etiology. We know that there are certainly environmental issues that can increase the risk. There are genetic risk factors. Matter of fact, having certain mutations in these muscle cells can lead to development of growth of the muscle in the uterine wall and causing these fibroids. We know that Black women more frequently have fibroids and perhaps more aggressive fibroids than white women, but very common to form these tumors. Most women will develop some at some point in their life. It's when they become symptomatic that we really need to worry about them. Again, the etiology is multifactorial, but most of the time these muscle cells develop a mutation, often in the gene called MED12, that will cause increased growth, proliferation, and the production of vast amounts of this extracellular matrix that causes them to swell up, and it can affect the surrounding uterine tissue that also makes it much bulkier, even in the areas not directly growing the fibroid. So it's a complex disease that we don't fully understand the etiology, but very, very, very common.
You know, you mentioned the Black women have this, have a higher prevalence two or three times. I might just add, they also tend to present with more severe symptoms. They might have it diagnosed at an earlier age, more likely to be anemic. And then I find that oftentimes the uteruses are larger in Black women compared to white women.
Yeah, absolutely. That corresponds to the biology we see of the more aggressive muscle cell growth in Black women compared to white women.
And, you know, Hugh, we both have done a lot of studies on fibroids, and I've always been intrigued by the fact that in different studies by different pharmaceutical companies, the size of the uterus doesn't correlate with the amount of menstrual blood loss. So intuitively, I think, you know, those larger uteruses, we think they would always bleed more, but that's not always true.
Not true at all. It's the location of the fibroid, and it's the impact on the rest of the uterus as well. A fibroid will have an effect on the uterine tissue surrounding it, and perhaps the entire uterus, because of the signaling molecules that come from that fibroid and all that extracellular matrix they're producing.
This helps tee up the next question, is how do uterine fibroids present in the clinic, and what are certain symptoms that are commonly associated with fibroids? So Dr. Lucas, if you could take a start on that.
Sure. So I think of fibroids predominantly presenting as abnormal bleeding, typically heavier bleeding, and then bulk symptoms. So with the bleeding, sometimes you just get heavy regular cycles, but oftentimes you can get prolonged bleeding. But typically, there's an increase in bleeding, and that can result in anemia with associated fatigue, hair loss, etc. And then bulk symptoms, if the uterus gets to be a certain size, can cause pressure, pain, and bladder and bowel issues. So urinary frequency, as well as constipation. So, and as Hugh mentioned earlier, about a third of women are symptomatic. But on exam, you may find someone have the uterine fibroids, yet they may not have any symptoms at all.
Absolutely. That's what we see, those, that heavy menstrual bleeding, often that regular heavy bleeding is the most common presenting symptom, but all the things that we just heard about, the pain, the bulk symptoms, the pressure on bladder or bowel, the anemia become very common. And I think this largely has to do with the location of the fibroids. Those fibroids impacting the endometrial cavity are the ones that are going to bleed. Those that are pedunculated or subserosal fibroids may not cause heavy menstrual bleeding, but are going to be the ones causing the bulk symptoms and the pain, irritating the bowel or bladder, depending on which side of the uterus they're coming from. But location, 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 like real estate, is what matters more than anything else in fibroids.
Can you address some of the challenges that are typically seen in the clinic with fibroid diagnosis, Dr. Taylor?
Yeah, I think there are several things that make this challenging. One is access. Not all patients have access to expertise in fibroid care by trained gynecologists. So very important that we make sure women can have access to good, high-quality care. There's so many different ways to treat fibroids as well that we'll get into later. Not everyone has access to all of the different treatment modalities. The other thing that I find is one of the most common problems is normalization of heavy menstrual bleeding. A lot of times this creeps up gradually as these fibroids grow over a number of years, and people don't always realize how bad it's gotten, or maybe have it dismissed because fibroids run in their family, and hear patients say, well, this is just our lot in life and our family to have these heavy periods. They normalize what is clearly abnormal bleeding. They develop the anemia, the fatigue. And I think we need to make sure that we educate people about how much bleeding is normal and how much is abnormal. And access to good ultrasound so we can determine the size and location of the fibroids as well. Those are some of the things that are the biggest challenges that I see out in practice.
Agree. So I think with the diagnosis, you know, certainly patient symptoms are important, but the provider needs to be suspicious and knowledgeable about fibroids. So I think a lot of it depends on the provider. I think I'm going to give the OBGYNs a pretty good grade for diagnosis, but I think sometimes the primary care providers don't think about it enough unless perhaps someone is, you know, remarkably anemic or something. So again, we have, I think most OBGYNs have a vaginal ultrasound. Many can do the SIS or saline infused sonogram and hysteroscopy, which can help characterize some of those submucosal fibroids.
Yeah, and I think people need to pay attention to this. As you said, not all primary care health providers are asking about the degree of menstruation, and we really need to think about proactively asking our patients. And if you don't have access to ultrasound, aren't familiar with all the different techniques for treating fibroids, both medical and surgical and minimally invasive techniques, it's important to refer them to someone who can treat them with all of the various methods available to us. But on the other hand, as we'll talk about later when we talk about medical therapy, it's gotten a lot easier for anyone to treat fibroids with medical therapy. So I hope that lower some of the barriers to these women getting appropriate treatment.
So certainly as you're considering the diagnosis of fibroids, family history is important. It's clear that there's a genetic risk factor for fibroids. So asking a woman if her mother had heavy periods or different female relatives had uterine fibroids is an important component of understanding the risk factors for an individual patient.
How do you identify the treatment strategy for a patient with fibroids? And what are certain typical criteria that need to be considered when you develop a treatment plan. Dr. Lucas?
Well, for me, I do want to understand, you know, a patient's desire for treatment. So there's going to be a portion of women who might have abnormal bleeding or bulk symptoms with their fibroids, and they want to understand why, but they may not elect to do anything about it. Understanding why that's happening and recognizing the impact it can have on their quality of life is enough. So as providers, you really want to understand the goals for the woman. And I like to treat or educate someone about all the different treatment options, whether they're medical, surgical, et cetera. And then certainly a woman's desire to either be pregnant or not be pregnant can influence the decision, your decision. Medical conditions, whether she would like to have surgery, et cetera, all play important parts to understanding what treatment path you're going to take.
I couldn't agree more. All those things are important in decision-making, age of the patient, fertility prospects. That's a key one because some of the treatments we have really aren't compatible with optimal pregnancy or fertility at all in the future. So that's one of the key factors. Then once you have some idea about the location, type of fibroids, the patient's desires, it really is a shared decision making with the patients. Go over all the options with them, and it's important to be familiar with all the different treatment options so you can decide with the patient what's best for them. It's not always a clear cut, black and white medical decision, but patient choice is really important in making these decisions.
And certainly in the older women, if they've had a recent change in bleeding, doing an endometrial biopsy, ruling out cancer, that certainly can, then you know what path you're likely going to use for treatment.
Absolutely critical that we not forget that. You don't want to miss a cancer.
In your view, what are certain challenges with the current available treatment options, and what do we need to overcome these challenges?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges is access. As we mentioned before, not everyone performs all of the different procedures that can be used to treat fibroids. So we need to make sure someone can counsel patients who's knowledgeable about all the treatment options, including referral to somebody who might do a treatment option that they themselves don't offer. And access is important. There are lots of choices, and I think knowing and keeping up to date on all the various choices, knowing when they're appropriate, is one of the biggest challenges. And podcasts like this will help us all keep up to date on the biggest challenges that we have facing fibroid treatment today, so we can appropriately educate patients, counsel them, and refer them to the right specialist for treatment.
There are going to be some OBGYNs that are very surgically focused, whether it's on definitive treatment versus minimally invasive. There are some people that are going to be much more leaning towards medical therapy. And I know we'll talk in a later session about the newer emerging treatments with GnRH antagonists that kind of give us very effective, safe treatments for women with fibroids.
And I think an important thing to remember is that not everyone needs treatment, that, again, most fibroids will be asymptomatic. Don't forget that conservative management may be appropriate, that we don't necessarily need to treat fibroids at all. There are minimally invasive treatments available. There are surgical treatments available, including definitive treatments such as hysterectomy at one extreme. And now there are more medical therapies available that are highly effective that we'll talk about in a bit. But again, I think that's really opened up the possibility for everyone to be able to offer some of the first line therapy for fibroids, even in a non-surgically focused practice, even in a primary care practice.
So what are certain surgical and non-surgical interventions that can be offered to patients with uterine fibroids?
Well, in the extreme case, somebody who's completed childbearing and wants to consider hysterectomy, that is definitive treatment. There will be no recurrence of fibroids. For someone who wants to preserve their fertility, retain their uterus, myomectomy is a possibility for fibroids, especially those protruding into the uterine cavity that are causing heavy menstrual bleeding or maybe causing infertility. A small fibroid that is within the uterine cavity can be easily removed hysteroscopically, and that would be a preferred surgical option. Larger fibroids that are causing bulk symptoms may require an open abdominal myomectomy. These days, more minimally invasive treatments are becoming commonplace with radiofrequency ablation. Laparoscopically guided radiofrequency ablation is an option. Uterine artery embolization, especially for those who have completed childbearing, because it affects the rest of the uterus, not just the fibroid. There is MRI-guided focused ultrasound that's available a couple places in the United States. Again, depends on the location of the fibroid, and but that's only available in a couple of centers in the U.S. Medical therapies, we've traditionally used oral contraceptives. They don't really treat the fibroids per se, but may control bleeding, though that or other progestin-containing regimens. A progestin-containing IUD may help minimize bleedings if the fibroids aren't distorting the cavity such that an IUD is not possible. Transuricic acid is used for controlling bleeding, although again, doesn't treat the fibroids. Traditionally, to actually shrink fibroids, medical therapy was restricted to GnRH agonists. These days, we have the GnRH antagonists, which are much more patient-friendly, effective regimens that we'll talk about in more detail later.
In addition, I also consider endometrial ablation as a minimally invasive procedure. Doesn't treat the fibroid directly, but it can help minimize bleeding. Further, the radiofrequency energy, in addition to laparoscopic approaches, there's now a hysteroscopic approach to deliver the radiofrequency energy to fibroids within the wall of the uterus.
All great choices, and it's important to counsel our patients on what's appropriate for them given the location of their fibroids and the symptoms they have, as well as to help them understand the implications of all the treatments and find the best choice for them.
That's all the time we have for today. In our second podcast, we will discuss disparities that exist in the management of uterine fibroids among minority populations. I would like to thank Dr. Andrea Lucas and Dr. Hugh Taylor for taking the time to speak with us. They will be joining us again to speak about some of the newer GnRH analogs in our next podcast. And thank you to all of our listeners for joining us. Make sure to listen to all four podcasts in this learning series, as well as other types of CME programs that are offered by the MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. A special thank you to Pfizer and Myovant Sciences, who provided an unrestricted grant for this educational activity. Have a lovely day.